Hey everyone, welcome back to the Deep Dive. So you're looking to really get a handle on this whole law thing, right? And I bet you're wanting to do it fast. Well, let me tell you, one of the quickest ways to learn is by diving deep into real-world cases, especially ones that tackle these knotty procedural questions, the kind that can really make or break a case.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. And today, we've got a real doozy for you.
Yeah.
We're going to unpack United States v. Ralph E. Taken Alive Jr., a decision out of the Eighth Circuit back in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about finding that sweet spot, that balance between making the courts run smoothly and ensuring everyone gets a fair shake, you know, when they're facing multiple charges.
Okay, so let's set the scene a bit. Late 2005, early 2006, we've got Ralph taken alive and his relationship with a woman named Susan Bears Hart. But things take a turn, and we end up with two separate assault incidents.
Exactly. The first one went down on February 9th. Taken Alive goes after a guy named Justin Farrell with a pipe. Brutal attack. Farrell ends up with skull fractures, a broken wrist, the whole nine yards.
And then, just about a month later, March 9th rolls around, and we have another incident. This time, it's with Clayton Elling.
Right. So the story goes, they're in a car together, and Elling starts mouthing off, insulting Taken Alive's father. Things escalate. Taken Alive ends up leaving Elling stranded by the side of the road.
And sadly, that's not where Elling's story ends. Later on, they find his body. Autopsy shows injuries like he was beaten pretty badly, blunt force trauma. But the official cause of death, hypothermia. He basically froze to death out there after being left incapacitated.
Yeah, that's a rough situation. And here's the kicker from a legal perspective. They decided to try both of these assaults, the one on Farrell and the one that led to Elling's death together, all in one go. In the end, Taken Alive was found guilty of voluntary manslaughter for Elling's death and assault for both victims. And that, my friend, is what set the stage for the appeal.
Gotcha. So both incidents tried together. One trial, one set of convictions. Makes sense why his lawyers might have a problem with that.
You bet they did. They went to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, arguing that lumping those two separate events together was a big procedural no-no. And on top of that, they said the prosecution just didn't bring enough evidence to the table to justify the manslaughter conviction. They had three main points they hammered on trying to get those trial court decisions overturned.
All right, let's break those arguments down, see what Taken Alive's team was trying to do.
Well, the first one was all about joining the charges, trying them together. They said it was improper under Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 8A. Second, they claimed there wasn't enough evidence presented at the trial to support that voluntary manslaughter conviction for Elling's death. And lastly, they argued there was a big prejudicial difference between the prosecution's story about how Elling died when they were presented to the grand jury versus what they emphasized during the actual trial, like they were shifting their narrative, which isn't exactly kosher.
Makes sense. So let's start with joinder, that first issue. What's the rule, the legal standard for when you can try multiple charges together like that?
It all comes around to Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 8A. That's the rule book for this kind of thing. Basically, it says you can join offenses if they're of the same or similar character, if they're based on the same act or transaction, or if they're connected as part of a common scheme or plan. The big idea here is efficiency, right? Keep the courts running smoothly, handle related stuff together in one fell swoop.
So how did the Eighth Circuit see these two assaults? Did they think they fit those criteria for being joined?
They did. The appellate court said both assaults were similar in character. Both involved some serious violence stemming from personal disputes, right? And they happened pretty close together, just a few weeks apart, same reservation. So the court saw a pattern, violent behavior as a response to conflict. That was the similarity they latched onto.
Now, this brings up another rule, doesn't it? Federal Rule of Evidence 404B. Something about using evidence of other crimes or bad acts. I remember that being relevant here.
Oh, absolutely. Rule 404B is key in this situation. It's all about when you can bring in evidence of other bad stuff the defendant might have done. See, the Eighth Circuit pointed out that evidence from each of these assaults, things about Taken Alive's intent or maybe the lack of a mistake on his part, that stuff could have been admissible, even if they had separate trials. Rule 404B allows for that kind of cross-admissibility. And that's a big deal. If you're going to use evidence of one crime in the trial for the other, anyway, the argument against trying them together kind of loses its scheme, doesn't it?
Right. I see the logic there. Okay, so the defense argued that trying these assaults together would be unfairly prejudicial to Taken Alive. How did the court address that, considering Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 14, you know, the one about severing charges?
Right. Rule 14. That's the defendant's escape hatch if they can show that a joint trial would really screw them over, unfairly prejudice them. But here's the rub. The bar is set really high. You got to prove unfair prejudice, not just any old prejudice. And in this case, the Eighth Circuit said, nope, you haven't shown us enough. They reasoned that because that evidence of each assault could probably come in anyway, thanks to 404B, and because the trial judge specifically told the jury to consider each charge separately with its own evidence, well, the defense just didn't prove that there was enough unfair prejudice to justify separate trials. This really shows you how much the courts value efficiency, especially when they feel like the risk of unfairness is being managed.
Makes sense. Okay, so let's move on to the second big argument in the appeal. Not enough evidence for that voluntary manslaughter conviction. We talked earlier about how there were no eyewitnesses to Elling's death, at least not in those final moments. So how did the prosecution build their case? What did they use?
They went the circumstantial evidence route. Classic example of that. Nobody saw Taken Alive deliver some fatal blow, right? But the prosecution laid out a whole story, a bunch of facts and expert opinions that painted a pretty clear picture. The key was the forensic pathologist. Their testimony was gold. They talked about all those broken ribs Elling had, said they were consistent with a severe beating. That's how they linked it all back to Taken Alive.
So the idea being that the beating left Elling too hurt to get help, leading to the hypothermia.
Exactly. And they didn't stop there. They brought in other stuff, too. For instance, court records show that Taken Alive made some incriminating statements. We don't know the specifics from what we have here, but the court clearly considered them important. Plus, there was the simple fact that Elling was last seen alive with Taken Alive right after that fight. So that's the timeline they built, the connection they established.
I see. So piece it all together. Serious injuries confirmed by the medical expert, statements from the defendant that didn't help his case, and the fact that he was the last one with the victim. The Eighth Circuit looked at all that and said, yep, a reasonable jury could totally find him guilty based on this, even without someone seeing the exact moment of death. It's really interesting how powerful a well-crafted circumstantial case can be.
Totally. It shows how the law can use logic, inferences from a bunch of facts, to figure out guilt. You don't always need that smoking gun, that direct proof.
For sure. Okay, let's tackle that third argument, the one about the prosecution seemingly changing their story about how Elling died. They presented one thing to the grand jury and then emphasized something slightly different at trial. What was that all about?
Right, so the defense argued that the prosecution went to the grand jury with a story that focused on hypothermia. Like that was the direct, immediate cause of death. But then at trial, they shifted gears a bit, putting more weight on the blunt force trauma from the beating. The idea being that the trauma was what incapacitated Elling, leading to him freezing to death. The defense was basically saying, hey, you're changing your tune, trying to fit the facts to your case.
And how did the Eighth Circuit rule on this? Did they agree with the defense that the prosecution had unfairly switched things up?
Nope. They dismissed it. Called it harmless error. They basically said, look, the trial jury, the one that matters, the Petit jury, they decided guilty based on the evidence connecting the assault to Elling's death. To them, whether the final nail on the coffin was the cold itself or the injuries from the beating, that wasn't the main point. What mattered was that the assault was the root cause. So they focused on what the trial jury heard and how they decided, not so much on any tiny differences in what was said to the grand jury. Their point was, even if there was a slight shift in the story, the trial was fair, the evidence was solid, and the verdict stands.
Interesting. So zooming out a bit, what are the big takeaways here? What should anyone trying to wrap their head around the law, especially future lawyers, really pay attention to in this case?
I'd say there are a few biggies. First, you see how Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 8, that joinder rule, it tends to be interpreted pretty broadly. The courts like to join charges when it makes things run smoother. Second, if you're going to try and sever charges under Rule 14, claiming unfair prejudice, well, good luck. It's a tough sell. Especially when, like here, the evidence for each charge could likely have come in anyway. The real trick is to show that being tried together creates some special unfair disadvantage that goes beyond just having the jury hear about more bad stuff.
Yeah, that's a good point. And we can't forget the whole circumstantial evidence thing. This case really highlights how you can get a conviction, even a serious one like manslaughter, without that direct eyewitness testimony. And the way they use the expert's analysis of the injuries and the defendant's own statements, that's textbook stuff for building a strong circumstantial case.
Absolutely. Yeah. It shows how important it is to have a thorough investigation and to be able to connect the dots, build a logical story from the facts. And one more thing. even if there are some differences between what's presented to the grand jury and what's presented at trial, it doesn't automatically mean the conviction gets tossed out.
Yeah.
Not if the trial jury's decision is based on solid evidence that covers all the essential parts of the crime. It's the trial that really counts.
Right. And there's another detail we should mention, even though it wasn't a major issue in this appeal. This case involved federal laws that apply specifically to crimes that happen on Native American reservations in Indian country. Specifically, we're talking about 18 U.S.C. sections 1112 and 1153. That adds a whole other layer to things, right? Something to keep in mind as you're navigating the legal world.
Oh, for sure. It's a good reminder that where a crime happens matters, big time. Location can determine which laws apply, which courts have jurisdiction. It can make a huge difference.
Absolutely. So there you have it, folks. We've gone deep on United States v. Ralph E. Taken Alive Jr. We've covered the facts, the legal arguments, the reasoning of the Eighth Circuit on joinder, circumstantial evidence, and that harmless error issue with the grand jury variances.
This case is a great example of how the law tries to juggle efficiency with fairness, two big concepts that are always bumping up against each other.
And that brings us to our final thought for today. Given how much the courts value efficiency in deciding whether to try similar charges together, what should they really be thinking about to make sure that efficiency doesn't end up sacrificing individual justice? What safeguards do we need, especially when there are multiple accusations involved? It's a tough question, one that touches on ethics and practicality.
I think that's a perfect note to end on. And for those of you who found this whole discussion fascinating, I'd recommend checking out the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. Rules 8 and 14 are the ones to focus on here. And if you really want to go down the rabbit hole, look into case law about other acts evidence. That's all about Rule 404B.
Solid advice. Well, we hope you found this deep dive valuable. Be sure to join us next time as we explore another fascinating corner of the law. Until then, keep those legal minds sharp.
See you next time.
Take care, everyone.